Richard Martin's Wake Up Call podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
A very warm welcome to all of you, ladies and gentlemen. This is your Wake Up Call coming to you from Penang on Monday, August the 31st, 2015, and I am your host, Richard Martin. Well, that didn't take long. After just 3 days of market turmoil, the Monetary Politburo swung into action. This time, they sent out B-Dud to promise still another monetary sweetener. Said the head of the New York Fed, and I quote, "From my perspective, at this moment, the decision to begin the normalization process at the September FOMC meeting seems less compelling to me than it was a few weeks ago." End of quote. Needless to say, B-Dud is a moniker implying extreme disrespect, and Bill Dudley deserves every bit of it. He is a crony capitalist fool and one of the Fed ringleaders prosecuting a relentless, savage war on savers. Its only purpose is to keep carrying trade speculators gorged with free funding in the money markets and to bloat the profits of Wall Street strip mining operations like that of his former employee, Goldman Sachs. The fact is, anyone who doesn't imbibe the Keynesian Kool-Aid dispensed by the central banking cartel can see in an instant that 80 months of zero interest rate policy has done exactly nothing for the Main Street economy. Notwithstanding the Fed's gussied up theories about monetary accommodation and closing the output gap, the litmus test is really simple. Artificial suppression of the free market interest rates by the central bank is designed to cause households to borrow more money than they otherwise would in order to spend more than they earn. Pure and simple. It's nothing more than a modernized version of the original crude Keynesian pump priming theory, except that it dispenses with the inconvenience of getting politicians to approve spending increases and tax cuts in favor of the writ of a small posse of unelected monetary mandarins who run the FOMC and peg money market interest rates at will. But the whole enterprise is a crock. The consumer spending pump can't be primed anymore because households reached a condition of peak debt at the time of the financial crisis. On the eve of the financial crisis in the first quarter of 2008, total household debt outstanding, including mortgages, credit cards, auto loans, student loans, and the rest, was $13.957 trillion. That compares to $13.568 trillion outstanding at the end of the first quarter 2015. That's right. After 80 months of zero interest rate policy and an unprecedented incentive to borrow and spend, households have actually liquidated nearly $400 billion, or 3% of their pre-crisis debt. Oh yes, there has been a change in the mix, with mortgages and credit card balances down and auto and student loan balances significantly higher. But debt is fungible. So the truth about the aggregate of all household debt is stunning. Namely, not a single dime of the Fed's $3.5 trillion quantitative easing bond buying spree left the canyons of Wall Street. This means that the entirety of private debt growth since the financial crisis and the exception of extraordinary monetary measures in the fall of 2008 has been in the business sector, and on a net basis, the modest growth of business debt during the last 7 years has been entirely recycled via stock buybacks, M&A deals, and LBOs back into the speculative pools of Wall Street. So here, in summary detail, is what B-Dud and the small clique of Wall Street shills surrounding the Fed are actually hiding. It is blindingly obvious that the household credit channel of Keynesian monetary stimulus is over and done. During the 20 years after Greenspan took the helm at the Fed, household debt rose like a rocket. From a level of $2.7 trillion in the third quarter of 1987, it exploded to just shy of $14 trillion by the first quarter 2008. That represented an 8.5% rate of growth for two decades running, thereby dramatically outpacing the 5.5% rate of normal nominal GDP growth during the same period. Accordingly, household debt was ratcheted up on a one-time basis from 55% of GDP to 95% by the eve of the crisis. So yes, Greenspan's activation of the Fed's printing press during that period did goose the GDP by mortgaging household balance sheets. But that was a one-time parlor trick that is over and done, and will now tax household incomes for the indefinite future. In fact, the destruction of the household credit channel of monetary transmission is even more drastic than is evident at first sight, because households do not pay interest and principal on their massive debt burdens out of gross domestic product, or even so-called disposable personal income. Nearly one quarter of DPI, for example, consists of transfer payments to old people and poor people, most of whom can't borrow at all or carry only minimal debt. Instead, most of the current $13.6 trillion of household debt is owed by middle-class wage and salary earners, and it is their pool of earned income that services most of the household debt. Accordingly, the household leverage figures remove any scintilla of doubt about the fact that the Fed is pushing on one huge limp string. Relative to wage and salary income, the exhaustion of the Greenspan Bernanke parlor trick is plain as day. Debt soared from 80% of wage and salary incomes in the 1970s, where it had traditionally been associated with healthy household finance, to 220% of wage and salary incomes by the eve of the financial crisis. But since then, it has rolled over and has therefore been a depressant to growth, not a stimulant. Another factor concerns the modest growth of business debt. This did not fuel added output either. Instead of spending for plant and equipment, thereby spurring measured GDP growth today and an economic productivity and efficiency over the long run, it went into financial engineering. So doing, it caused the massive inflation of existing financial assets in the secondary markets and thereby delivered untold windfalls to the 1% who speculate there. Thus, at the end of the first quarter 2008, non-financial business debt stood at $10.4 trillion, and since then has grown to $12.2 trillion. But about $500 billion of that went into increased balance sheet cash, leaving a net debt gain of $1.3 trillion. While this gain is modest compared to the fourfold increase in net business debt between 1987 and 2008, the more important point is that the business channel of monetary policy transmission is broken too. The Fed's drastic falsification of financial asset prices has turned management of corporate America into a giant gambling parlor. On the margin, all of the gains in business debt since 2008 have been flushed right back into Wall Street in the form of stock buybacks and debt-financed takeovers. The evidence that zero interest rates have not promoted business borrowing for productive investment is also plain to see. During the most recent year, 2014, U.S. businesses spent $431 billion on plant equipment and software after depreciation. That was 7% less than net business investment in 2007. And these are nominal dollars. So all other things being equal, net business debt could have fallen over the past 7 years. This actual gain in net debt outstanding self-evidently went into financial engineering, that is, back into the Wall Street casino. Here's the thing. You don't need fancy econometric regression analysis or DSGE models to see that zero interest rate policy is a macroeconomic dud. Simple empirical data trends show it hasn't goosed household borrowing and consumption spending, nor has it stimulated business investment. If you feel instinctively that this is the case just by looking around you, I can assure you, you are not mistaken. Your instincts are perfectly well founded. And you are not alone. There are plenty of qualified people in all walks of life that are in total agreement, whatever the mainstream media may have to say. And that's what makes Dudley, Yellen, and the rest of the posse so detestable. They are deliberately and knowingly deploying formulaic Keynesian incantations about an allegedly incomplete and fragile recovery, with the sole purpose of continuing to pleasure Wall Street speculators with several more months of free carry trade funding and, by every indication, several more years of money market rates that are tantamount to zero. Never mind what they say. Don't listen to their lies. Believe your own eyes. For crying out loud, a fragile macroeconomy has nothing to do with it. Zero interest rates have not goosed Main Street activity for 80 months now. So why would a rounding error 25 basis points or even 50 basis points rate in the money markets have any impact whatsoever? Obviously, it wouldn't. This is all about the Fed's deathly fear that Wall Street will stage a hissy fit if it's not guaranteed free or quasi-free gambling stakes for the indefinite future. That's why the Monetary Politburo dispatched B-Dud out to calm the robo-machines and hedge fund gamblers on Wednesday. Yet what about the tens of millions of Main Street savers and retirees who are being financially ruined by the writ of B-Dud and the FOMC? In a word, they are being sacrificed to the harebrained theory that the central bank can create lasting gains in output and societal wealth by rigging the price of debt and inflating the value of risk assets by subsidizing ceaseless gambling in the casino. And do not think harebrained is an excessive term. There is an ingrown circle of a few hundred monetary apparatchiks in the world that now runs the whole central banking horror show. In addition to the governing boards of the Fed, the European Central Bank, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, the People's Bank of China, and their senior staffs, there are perhaps a few dozen economists and financial journalists that complete the circle of groupthink. Among these are the blatantly Keynesian editorial writers and commentators of the Financial Times. in a recent editorial that is so outrageously daffy that it could have been posted in The Onion. The Financial Times let the cat out of the bag. What these unspeakably dangerous fools argued was that cash should be abolished so that the central banks could get on with their job of stimulating depressed economies by setting interest rates at negative nominal rates. In other words, it is apparently not enough that someone who saved $150,000 over a lifetime of work and foregone consumption should earn just $1 per day of interest on liquid savings, deposits, or treasury bills. No, the central banker's posse now actually wants to expropriate these savings by extracting a monthly levy and by throwing anyone in jail who attempts to hide their wealth outside the controlled banking system by keeping it in private scrip or unconfiscated greenbacks. Since this very idea amounts to a frontal assault on civil liberties and economic justice, it is best to let the Financial Times condemn itself with its own words, and believe me, I proudly quote. But even as individuals have taken recent crises as reasons to stock up on banknotes, authorities would do well to consider the arguments for phasing out their use as another barbarous relic the moniker Keynes gave to gold. Already, by far, the largest amount of money exists and is transacted in electronic form as bank deposits and central bank reserves. But even a little physical currency can cause a lot of distortion to the economic system. The existence of cash, a bearer instrument with a zero interest rate, limits central banks' ability to stimulate a depressed economy. The worry is that people will change their deposits for cash if a central bank moves rates into negative territory. The Swiss, Danish, and Swedish central banks have pushed rates lower than many thought possible, but most policymakers still believe in an effective lower band, not far below zero. With a recovery underway in most rich countries, this may seem academic. The talk is now of when to raise rates, but the fear of the lower band is still causing damage. The dominant argument for beginning to the tightening cycle is to have enough ammunition for a new stimulus when the next downturn comes. Removing the lower band would leave central banks well equipped to deal with a slowdown, even from near zero starting points. End of quote. There you have it. The private economy and its millions of savers exist for the convenience of the apparatchik who run the central bank. And this view is not limited to the editorial scribblers at the FT. Their reasoning was identical to that offered by Kenneth Rogoff, the former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, who recently advocated abolishing high denomination banknotes, such as the 100 euro and 500 euro notes. So B. Dud was sent out to save the day for Wall Street, but it had nothing to do with the incoming data. He was acting for a small posse of destructive monetary rulers who have turned themselves hostage to the furies of the casino. In their palpable fear and unrelieved arrogance, would they now throw millions of already ruined retirees and savers completely under the bus? Yes, actually, they would. All right, well, a recent study found that 13,000 people in LA County fall into homelessness every month, which is a dramatic increase from previous years. The group's analysis was based on records for 9 million county residents who received public assistance at any point between 2002 and 2010. The 2007 to 2010 recession also drove many out of their homes, it said. The latest official homeless count found 44,000 people living in county streets in a three-day period in January, a 12% increase in 2 years. The survey also found a 37% rise in chronically homeless people. Another example is San Francisco. After engaging in a 10-year campaign to end homelessness in their city, they still have the exact same number of homeless people they had before. That may not sound too bad until you realize that the city established 2,800 housing units for the homeless in that same time period. So basically, the homeless rate has only remained flat due to government intervention and would be significantly higher otherwise. They can't afford to house themselves, in part because housing and rental prices are ridiculously high. Many people can't afford anything at all and have to take their chances in the streets. The Fed's monetary policy is driving people into homelessness. It's a machine that produces nothing but dependence. Meanwhile, America's debt burden continues to grow to extraordinary levels, and many municipalities are hanging by threadbare budgets. Well, Thomas DeMint's voice is heard only briefly on the 8-minute video he took of police officers arresting two of his friends and body slamming their mother. "I'm videotaping this, sir," he tells an officer. "I'm just videotaping this." What's not seen is what happened just after he stopped recording. DeMint says three officers tackled him, took away his smartphone, and then tried, unsuccessfully, to erase the video. They then arrested him on charges of obstruction of governmental administration and resisting arrest. "I am 100% innocent," the 20-year-old Long Island College student told reporters earlier this month. "I didn't do anything wrong. I was just there to videotape." Well, civil liberties experts say DeMint is part of a growing trend of citizen videographers getting arrested after trying to record police behavior. It's a backlash that comes as smartphones have made it easier than ever to make such recordings, which have become key evidence in high-profile cases of alleged excessive force, including the shooting of a fleeing suspect by an officer in South Carolina, the dragging of a Baltimore man into a police van, and the chokehold death of a New York City man on a Staten Island sidewalk. According to Chris Dunn, associate legal director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, and I quote, "By all accounts, the situation has gotten worse. People are more inclined to pull out their phones and record. But that is often met with a very bad response from police." End of quote. Mickey Oesterreicher, general counsel of the National Press Photographers Association, said he hears of almost 4 incidents a week in which police either harass, interfere, or arrest citizens, not journalists, for shooting video. He notes this is occurring at the same time many police departments are deploying body cameras on officers. Oesterreicher said, and I quote, "There is no reasonable expectation of privacy on either side. Citizens can record police, and police can record citizens when either is out on the street in a public place." End of quote. What makes the situation hard to define, civil libertarians say, is that no one is ever arrested on a charge of recording police, because that has widely been upheld as protected under the First Amendment. Instead, they are being hauled into court on obstruction, resisting arrest, or other charges. A North Carolina man who says he, quote-unquote, kept a safe distance last spring while recording police taking his friend into custody at a bar was nonetheless booked on resisting and obstructing an arrest, charges that were later dropped. A month earlier in Missouri, a man claimed he was arrested after recording the police response to a small protest outside the Ferguson Police Department. He says that as soon as he took a step into a street that was blocked by police, he was booked on a disorderly conduct charge. In some cases, the arrests are costing taxpayer money. Earlier this year, the city of Portland, Maine, paid $72,000 to settle a lawsuit by a couple who were arrested after they filmed police questioning a suspected drunk driver. In New York, a freelance videographer arrested after a Long Island police sergeant ordered him to stop recording the arrest of a suspect settled a federal civil rights lawsuit last year for $200,000. DeMint is also considering a civil case against police who accused him of being combative and refusing to obey officers' orders to get back when he was arrested last year. His case is still pending. Chief Kevin Fallon, a Suffolk County police spokesman, declined to comment on DeMint's case specifically, but said, and I quote, "Video is certainly here to stay, and people have a right to take video, but they don't have a right to interfere." End of quote. Jonathan Turley, a law professor at George Washington University, said the right to take videos of police encounters in public is clearly protected by the First Amendment. He said, "The typical trend is for police to detain people who are shooting video and subsequently drop the charges." Quoting Turley, "Exercising this right has consistently and uniformly been upheld by state and federal courts. They have made it abundantly clear that citizens have a right to film police in public. What is alarming is the degree to which police are ignoring this clear precedent and continue to threaten citizens." End of quote. The New York City CLU has been fighting back with an app that automatically uploads citizen videos to a central server as soon as a video is recorded, preserving the evidence even if the smartphone is seized. More than 35,000 New Yorkers have downloaded the app since its launch in 2012, leading to tens of thousands of video submissions. And 17 ACLU affiliates around the country have adapted the app for their communities. Earlier this month, California Governor Jerry Brown signed the Right to Record Act, which declares people may not be prevented from recording the police, provided they do not interfere with the officers performing their duties. State Senator Ricardo Lara said the legislation, quote, "reinforces our First Amendment right and ensures transparency, accountability, and justice for all Californians." At a time when cell phone and video footage is helping steer important national civil rights conversations, passage of the Right to Record Act sets an example for the rest of the nation to follow. End of quote. Well, this story came to me courtesy of Gilbert Persinich, and I thought it worthy enough to relay it to you. After years of struggling financially, Susan Rick thought things were looking up when her boyfriend won $250,000 from the Illinois lottery last month. She could stop working 7 days a week, maybe fix up the house and take a trip to Minnesota to visit her daughter. But because Illinois lawmakers have not passed a budget, she and her boyfriend, Danny Chasteen, got an IOU from the lottery instead. Under state law, the state comptroller must cut the checks for lottery winnings of more than $25,000. And lottery officials said that because lawmakers have yet to pass a budget, the comptroller's office doesn't have legal authority to release the funds. Illinois lottery spokesman Steve Rossi said, and I quote, "The lottery is a state agency like many others, and we're obviously affected by the budget situation. Since the legal authority is not there for the comptroller to disperse payments, those payments are delayed." End of quote. While Rossi said winners will eventually receive their money once a budget is in place, the promise is cold comfort for Rick. He makes a good point, quote, "You know what's funny? If we owed the state money, they'd come take it. And they don't care whether we have a roof over our head. Our budget wouldn't be a factor. You can't say to the state, 'Can you wait until I get my budget under control?'" End of quote.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
All right, time for a few emails, I think, at this point. So let's start with an anonymous email, which goes as follows. "Hello, Richard. Listening to Why Such Generalized Complacency About Everything, and thought I better send you a morale-boosting email. I am an avid rural Canadian listener and want you to know that your message is much appreciated and has never been more relevant. I am shocked by how most people take absolutely no leadership role in their own lives," all in caps, by the way, "and have no idea how to assess the return on investment of their own efforts because they have no particular goal in mind besides treading water, cutting ongoing expenses, living in a peaceful, multi-generational rural enclave, and keeping an eye on municipal politics to be sure the municipality doesn't take on unnecessary debt in the form of endless studies or needless construction projects, or allow ridiculous increases in property assessments, which could tax us off our own property years down the road, are a few of the shelter-in-place tactics many rural Canadians are taking in order to survive yet another depression. Farmers have very, very long memories," in caps. "Those with too many debts or excessive entanglement in government-backed and monitored agricultural projects have lost their farms in the past. Today, the overextended will end up being squeezed out by the TPP when our market is flooded with dumped products from the European Union and Mexico. Cheese, wine, fruit and veggies, etc. How can you pay back a loan or meet the ever-increasing regulatory overhead when the imported products are sold below your own cost of production? Worth noting, all Canadian farmers have to deal with winter and is never mentioned as a cost of doing business here. Globalized agriculture has never been a level playing field. Consider that the state of California is allowing the mega agri-food businesses to pump out the last of their life-sustaining aquifers to maintain field crop production, for now. Blessed with a 365-day-a-year growing season, the mega agri-food businesses are thoughtlessly preparing to create another dust bowl while simultaneously making it impossible for small players in Canada ever to get into the American marketplace on a large enough scale to be ready to feed the Americans when their own productivity starts tanking. Even now, Canadians are not able to feed our own people who have become accustomed to cheap, trucked in food from the States? Not for long. The Canadian dollar lost 25% against the US dollar in 1 year, and food prices are going up, although food is still relatively cheap in Canada versus Europe. Again, for now. Richard, complacency about everything comes in so many forms that I have no pretensions of being able to wake up anyone anymore. Nobody outside my local community would waste 1 second listening to a middle-aged lady who chooses to be frugal so as to have time to think and read and grow a garden. I understand what it means to be out of step with the surrounding culture. Still, that will never stop me from being a leader in my own extended family. Following the example of those who lived on this farm before me, I am devoting my life to subsistence family farming, supplemented with part-time off-farm income, knowing that our GMO and pesticide-free crops and fields provide us with healthy food and a modicum of freedom. In this increasingly insane world, and that our land will continue to be of value to our descendants. I know many people aren't as fortunate as those in our old-fashioned rural Canadian clans, but I also know most people would never be able to tolerate the hardships our ancestors endured to provide us with this legacy, a legacy we're trying not to squander. Please don't use my name on air. No problem. Very nice email, very thoughtful and very prescient. Thank you so much. Right, let's take an email from Steve Canero. Okay, why don't we care? I believe because each of the 50 states is like its own country, and we feel very separate from the 400 to 500 politicians in Washington, D.C., where the power is centralized. Americans don't care about each other the way the French or the Swedes do. We are all from diverse backgrounds and groups. In fact, we despise each other. As long as we can pay our shelter costs, afford internet service, cable TV, and fast food, we're good. We won't get involved. And anyone that marches or protests is seen as slightly crazy. I will tell you why I gave up. 1. I was a big supporter of Ralph Nader, and the DNC sued him in every state to take away his right to even run for the presidency. Terry McAuliffe was the head of the DNC at the time, a total scumbag, but he has since been rewarded with elected office. They tried to destroy one of the few great men we have. Nader has never compromised his morals, has great courage, and has been an advocate not for money, but the public good, his entire adult life. Ron Paul is a good man, not a great man. And not only did I find major flaw with libertarianism, but I was disappointed he didn't have the guts to run independently at the height of his popularity. We also must note what they did to JFK. The rumblings on the internet are that he was going to take back control of the monetary system from the Fed. I still write in Ralph Nader's name when voting for president. He's getting older. If he passes away, I'm not sure I will continue to vote. 2. We defeated the Paulson bailout in the House. I remember watching C-SPAN as the votes were tallied. It was a great moment. I participated in calls and emails to my representatives. It wasn't a huge effort, but it was something. I also sent emails to family and friends saying to get involved, either for or against it. None of them cared. A week or two later, lawmakers dressed up Paulson's 2-page request for $700 billion and resubmitted it and got it through while we were a bit fatigued. At that moment, I realized You can't win by using the system, as the system is rigged. This is why I knew fighting the TPP was an absolute waste of time. I was surprised when you implored your listeners to go down this dead-end street unless you were trying to teach them a harsh lesson. End of rant. Best, Steve. Yes, it was partly that, Steve. Partly the fact that there is absolutely no use in doing something useful like trying to get lawmakers to change their minds when the system has decided for those lawmakers how they shall vote. But I also wanted to see how many people could get fired up by something as egregious as the TPP. I never really got an answer to that, but I do believe from the echoes that I've had that a fair number of you have in fact bestirred yourselves to try to do your best to keep this thing out of law. All right. Finally, we get an email from Zakai Free in Washington, D.C., which states as follows. Richard, you left PRN and I searched podcasts to find your updated commentaries. Americans are addicted to artificially sweet infotainment. I appreciate your straight no-chaser warnings backed with fact. I am a husband and father of two young children. I recently left my job paying six figures because I was unwilling to participate in lying to the public housing residents with whom I was working. I've since started Resonant Impact Media, dedicated to telling stories of excellence and resilience from marginalized communities. Truly, my wife and I are focused on building up our financial resources to leave the US in the next 2 years. Most people have no clue what lies in store for this country and much of the world. I often remind people that if karma is real, America is overdue for a comeuppance. Once again, thanks for all of the research and analysis which furthers our resolve to do something different somewhere else. Be well. Zaka Free, Washington, D.C. Well, here's a story about how U.S. sugar policies just helped America lose 600 jobs. The manufacturer of Oreo cookies recently announced plans to move production of Oreos from Chicago to Mexico, resulting in a loss of 600 U.S. jobs. This should be a wake-up call to defenders of the U.S. sugar program and other job-destroying trade barriers. The leading ingredient in Oreos is sugar, and U.S. trade barriers currently require Americans to pay twice the average world prices for sugar. Unlike oil, where there are differences between grades, sugar is pretty much sugar. But there are two futures prices. Sugar number 11, the global price, and sugar number 16, the US price, thanks to tariffs. Sugar number 11, $10.44. Sugar number 16, $24.50. US sugar costs 135% more than other countries pay. And economic fools, including unions, want more tariffs to, quote-unquote, protect U.S. jobs. Sugar-using industries now have a big incentive to relocate from the United States to countries where access to their primary ingredient is not restricted. If the government wants people making Oreo cookies and similar products to keep their jobs, a logical starting point would be to eliminate the U.S. sugar program, including barriers to imported sugar. This obvious connection between the lost jobs and sugar quotas was missed by many observers. According to one online comment, quote unquote, "This is why tariffs on products coming to U.S. must be raised." According to a 2006 report from the government's International Trade Administration, quote, Chicago, one of the largest U.S. cities for confectionery manufacturing, has lost nearly one-third of its SCP manufacturing jobs over the last 13 years. These losses are attributed in part to high U.S. sugar prices. End of quote. For example, the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers and Grain Millers Union consistently has opposed free trade agreements with sugar-producing countries like Australia, Brazil and Mexico, the kind of trade deals that just might protect their members' jobs. As I've said, tariffs cost jobs. Yet we hear asinine cries to raise tariffs to protect jobs. Such sweet deals, haha, pun intended, preserve a few jobs, in this case of overly expensive sugar production that is really far better suited to the tropics, at the huge expense of any manufacturer in the US that needs sugar. Net, net, sugar tariffs have cost the US countless jobs. And the sweet deal Obama worked out in the Trans-Pacific Partnership protects, among other things, sugar. Oh, and by the way, you do realize that to call TPP a free trade agreement is ridiculous. A true free trade agreement would consist of precisely one line of text, as in, all tariffs and all government subsidies on all goods and services will be eliminated immediately. What else is there to say? Well, this was such an unlikely, unbelievable, yet simple story of police brutality that I felt I had to bring it to your attention. It is a pathetically short story, so it won't take up too much of our time. A 61-year-old Pennsylvania man, Jim Osh, likes to go out into public and sing as a means of relieving stress. Last Friday, however, Osh's stress relief was to be met with police brutality. As Osh walked down the sidewalk in front of Schuler's Steakhouse in downtown Allentown, the restaurant guests seemed to be pleasantly receptive. Many of them pulled out their phones to record him singing the Beach Boys' Barbara Ann. After wrapping up his song, though, Osh was met with police violence instead of applause. Osh seemed to be agitated by the police presence and looked to have heated words with the officer. However, at no time did Osh touch the officer or otherwise warrant the violent action that followed. After he turned to walk away, the officer, who has yet to be named by the department, grabbed Osh and threw the man to the ground, causing him to scream in agony. According to Luisa Ramis Sows, who posted the video to Facebook, which I have seen, by the way, the guards claimed that Osh touched the officer. However, according to the video, this was entirely false. Though Osh was arrested and held in a jail cell for over an hour, police did not inform him of any charges, only saying, according to Osh, that he would be cited by mail. This is likely due to the fact that he hadn't broken any laws. One more for good measure, police terrorized a naked woman and her children at gunpoint last week during a no-knock raid on the wrong apartment. Marianne Diaz said she was awakened at about 5:30 a.m. on Wednesday by SWAT officers knocking down the door to her Worcester, Massachusetts apartment as officers wearing helmets and shields burst inside and pointed big guns at her heads, reported the Telegram and Gazette. Stop fucking crying and take care of your fucking kids, one officer commanded, Diaz said. Diaz said her 7-year-old daughter was shaking in terror as she held her 18-month-old daughter in her lap. And she said officers would not allow her to cover up for about 10 minutes after a woman officer frisked her nude body. "It was terrorizing and the worst thing I've ever been through in my life," Diaz told WBZ-TV. "They were loud, vulgar and disgusting in behavior." Police were looking for a man who had previously lived in the apartment where the 23-year-old Diaz has lived since May with her children, her 23-year-old fiancé and a 27-year-old mutual friend. Prosecutors said Friday that police acted on the best information they had before obtaining a search warrant from a Central District Court judge, but court documents show the man police were looking for had been arrested nearly 2 weeks earlier and listed another address as his home. The affidavit shows no indication that State Trooper Nicholas Nason had first-hand knowledge the man still lived in Diaz's apartment or that any surveillance had been conducted on the residence. The Registry of Motor Vehicles shows two people claim the apartment as their residence. Diaz, who has no criminal record and pays the utility bills under her own name, and another man with a lengthy criminal record. Police listed no evidence of a relationship between Diaz and that man, who authorities considered armed and dangerous. "I'm really upset about that," Diaz said. "If they knew I lived there and had no criminal record, and the electricity was under my name, then why do this and use excessive force?" Officers burst through the front and back doors of the third-floor apartment, throwing Diaz's fiancé, Bryant Alaquin, and their roommate, Joshua Watos, to the ground. "I screamed and tried to explain my wrist was messed up," said Watos, whose fractured wrist was re-broken during the raid. "They told me to shut the fuck up." After officers failed to turn up any drugs, weapons, or the target of their warrant, Diaz said they started murmuring to one another. "Oh shit, the snake got away," one officer said, according to Diaz. Diaz has asked the city and police department to investigate why the raid was permitted in the first place, but prosecutors have already said it was executed in the manner it was for the safety of all involved. End of quote. Well, everyone paying attention knows that the size of the derivatives market dwarfs the global economy. Paul Wilmot, who holds a doctorate in applied mathematics from Oxford University, has written several books on derivatives. Wilmot estimates the derivatives market at $1.2 quadrillion. To put that in perspective, it is about 20 times the size of the world economy. The world's annual gross domestic product is around $5 trillion. The Bank of International Settlements regularly publishes tables showing the amounts of different types of derivatives, but these categories are ambiguous, making it hard to get a good handle on what's really out there. You know, what I'm trying to do by speaking to you of all this is to draw your attention to the insanity of derivatives as an instrument or tool to add stability to the financial system. By stacking risk upon risk and transferring it off to another party who may not be able to perform or is over-leveraged, you do not increase stability. Derivatives do just that, and the parties involved often do not even understand the terms and implications of what they've signed. To make things more complicated, cross-border agreements blur regulations, legal jurisdictions, and laws. A collapse or default often results in years of legal wrangling and finger-pointing, rather than a swift payout or settlement. This is why I refer to derivatives as a house of cards. When one party fails, these agreements are often so highly leveraged that the transfer of the obligation or debt can put massive pressure and strain upon another party. We must question the quality of many of these contracts and worry about the potential of them to turn toxic. Contagion from insuring a contract or acting as an agent in case of default can be devastating, with the obligation shifting to another party rather than simply vanishing. As the saying goes, you can squeeze all you want, but you'll never get blood out of a turnip. This will be what happens with those on the hook for trillions of dollars when the silly but all too real derivatives markets head south. Again, we're talking about paper and promises that can vanish rather than tangible and hard assets. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, our Destination Penang seminar is now well and truly over. We still have a couple of stragglers who are staying on in Penang to sample the delights of what Penang has to offer. And I have, as many of you will know, now recorded some comments from the participants, or some of the participants, and those have been placed into Dropbox, and Donald Willing should be available on a separate broadcast for you to listen to. There's about 15-16 minutes worth of comments. I think you will find them informative, and I am sure that many of you who are on the sidelines wondering whether to come or not will find these comments extremely encouraging. They come from people who, frankly, had no idea what Penang was all about, and in some cases didn't even know where Penang was on a map. They didn't even know which country it was in, but we provided them with what I think was a very full and complete seminar lasting 4 days of information and visits, and I think they have got a lot out of it. People who came somewhat skeptical have gone away really enthused by the whole idea. One gentleman has said he is already signing up to return to our next seminar in January. Well, I find that to be very encouraging, and he has not done this before, so he knows the score, he knows the ropes, and I have a lot of gratitude to extend to Johnny Muller in Guatemala, who was a tremendous help to me in giving me a lot of good ideas about how this should be run, how it should be performed, and the seminars and visits were largely modeled on his own approach. And one particular person did comment that the seminar was similar in style. So I hope we've done you justice, Johnny, and I do thank you immensely for all your help in encouraging us to go ahead with this. And so, ladies and gentlemen, it just remains for me to wish you well and have a wonderful week ahead. I'm sure our participants will suffer from a good deal of jet lag when they get back, in the same way that they suffered when they arrived. But we did give them an extra day to recover, courtesy of the curvature of the Earth, which will in fact provide them with one extra day of life on the planet. So with that, I will wish you all the best. This is Richard Martin saying have a wonderful week. I will be back next Friday, as always. Take care. Until then, bye-bye.
And there you have it. You decide.